You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, Episode 11, Sisko's Blue Beard. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be looking at some Star Trek news, including retro action figures, interviews with Terry Farrell, Alice Krieger, and Connor Trinneer, a possible animated series from Roberto Orci, and five-year missions, Year 2. In the feature, we'll be joined by Down in Front's Brian Finifter to discuss the five Star Trek captains. Oh, and Greg apologizes. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How is life up there in Tiny Tower this week?
Tiny Tower is growing taller and taller by the day. Oh, dear. How about for you? How's it going?
It's going okay down here. You know, it is so hot here today that I'm pretty sure I'm on a demon planet. And in fact, I peeked out of the window a minute ago, and there's a puddle of silver fluid forming underneath our car, and our car is beginning to sink. And I also just saw a duplicate of myself walk by, so I'm a little bit worried.
Well, that could help. He can do half the work for you.
I think the Silver Blood are here at my place right now.
That's scary.
All right. So what do we have up in Star Trek news this week?
Well, we actually need to start the show with an apology.
Oh, that's
fans.
Right. You did something really bad, Greg, last week.
Yeah, I did. I'm so sorry. I talked about the sci-fi show Eureka, which I thought was really fantastic. And the next day, sci-fi announced that they were canceling their plans to give Eureka a sixth season and canceling it after the fifth season. And I take full responsibility.
It's all your fault. As our friend TrekGen named you, you are Greg the Cancel King. And after so much praising of Eureka that we did on this show last week, and we talked about Will Wheaton, Jerry Ryan, and all, and then here we go. And you know, I heard some other very troubling news for a lot of Star Trek fans, which is that apparently Twitter is going to be canceled as well. Because I heard yesterday that Twitter is going to become the plot point in the Sci-Fi Channel series Haven. Is that right?
Right. Yep.
Haven.
Yep.
Which can only mean one thing. It means that Twitter is going to be canceled. So everyone just get ready. Get your Google Plus invites in because we're going to need a new place to go.
Indeed.
I believe.
Well, so there is a silver lining kind of for Eureka fans. There is a fifth season still coming next year. And actually, they might air half of it next year and then half of it the next year. So there's a good chance there's two more years of Eureka still on the horizon. And I don't think we've talked about this yet, you and I, Chris. Sci-Fi announced this morning as we're recording that they're giving the show one more episode to sort of do a wrap-up season finale. So they did relent slightly on the, we're going to stop it and you're not going to get a good ending.
Yeah, I did see that. I guess that's the collective outcry from Twitter and social media.
Right.
A lot of angry tweets going out about that. I think people are just, it's a problem. I think sci-fi runs the risk here of alienating all the viewers because they're canceling everything. And when I think we talked about on here before, when we talked about Enterprise, that when Enterprise was canceled, I was kind of thinking at that time, like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if sci-fi could pick up Enterprise and finish the series, finish the final three seasons. And it just shows how much things have changed since then.
So,
you can't even rely on this, but
still check out Eureka. You know, I can't get it any more canceled than it already is. So, please, everyone who's listening, check out the show, and I think you'll be happy you did.
Yeah, and one more thing to all the listeners: if there's any show that you don't like and you want us to talk about it on here, Greg will be more than happy to see if he can get that show canceled for you. So just let us know. Just go to trek.fm/contact and just let us know which show you want us to talk about. It doesn't have to be Star Trek or science fiction. It can be anything.
Right.
Just let us know.
Anything at all. Right. So, moving on to a little bit of news. There's obviously Star Trek Las Vegas is starting up as we're recording this, but there's not really any news about it yet. So you're gonna have to wait for next week. We're gonna start getting some reports in and some things that are happening at that convention. So we have some other news this week. First of all, some toys that are coming out. We've talked a little bit about toys on the show. I always love to bring these up. There's a company, Diamond Select Toys, are working together with Art Asylum to make a sort of retro series of toys based on the Mego line of toys in the 70s. Chris, are you familiar with this line of toys?
A bit. You know, I mean, to be honest with you, I probably had some because I grew up in the 70s. But yeah, it was a big popular brand toy maker at that time. Mm. And like you said, these are really retro looking from not only the figures definitely bring back memories for me, this style of figure for sure. And but not just the figures, but the packaging also is very retro feel to it.
Yeah, it's cool. Like recently they've been doing things like, I remember with Enterprise, they did 3D scans of all the actors' faces to make the molds for the toys. And this is absolutely nothing like that. Obviously, an artist went in and made sort of cartoony looking molds for Captain Pike, the Salt Vampire, I believe Christine Chapel, and the, what was her name? I don't want to just call her the Orion Slave Girl.
Oh, gosh. Does she have? Yeah, I guess she did.
She had a name in the show.
In there.
Oh, Vina. I think Vina was her name.
Vina. Yeah, you're right.
Yes.
Obviously something that collectors are going to want to pick up. And, you know, I was thinking, looking at these, that I kind of see a missed opportunity here, though.
Yeah?
Recently, we pointed out, well, there's been a trend. There's been the Enterprise pizza cutter, and there's been the Enterprise and Galileo shuttle salt and pepper shakers. And what I think the missed opportunity here is that obviously this salt vampire should be a salt shaker.
The salt vampire salt shaker. That's perfect.
Yeah, salt vampire salt shaker. I mean, somebody needs to get on that right away. But there's another thing here too, which are these busts.
Mm-hmm.
Kirk and Picard busts. And what did you think about these?
Yeah, so this was interesting. So it's sort of the opposite. So it's neither the 3D scan, but it's also not very cartoony. These are very detailed busts of Captain Kirk and Captain Picard. And I think they look fantastic. One thing that's really interesting to me is they showcase the differences between the captains. Kirk is obviously on an away mission. He has his communicator in one hand and his phaser in the other hand, and he's ready to shoot somebody or, you know, drop the phaser and punch somebody. Whereas Picard is simply, he has his hand out, and I'm pretty sure he's saying, you know, make it so or engage. So it definitely shows the differences between these captains in very iconic poses.
Yeah, you see things like this fairly often. And I will say about these that the faces are much better done than some of the ones that I see. Sometimes they mm-hmm. don't quite look like the characters. You know, I've seen one of Spock where the lips are really odd. And
yeah.
It just kind of throws you off a bit. These, the faces, the bodies and all, are really nicely done. I find them, I don't know if I could have this sitting in my studio because the legs are a little bit disconcerting for me, the way that the legs just taper off into this base at the bottom.
It's a bit odd.
Maybe you put them where they're like sticking up from behind a shelf or something. but they're pretty nice, and it looks like they're going to sell for, what, $79.99?
Yeah, I thought the busts were pretty well priced. I could see paying $79.99 for the Kirk or Picard. The cloth Mego-style toys are retailing for $35.99 a piece, which I think considering their niche appeal makes sense, but that's awfully high for me for an action figure.
Yeah, I agree. The bust price is pretty good, I think. The figures, yeah, $35.99 seems a bit high for me. I guess when you see figures these days, I haven't bought any figures in a while, but if you just, any type of movie figures that you might pick up, I think the prices are quite a bit more than what they used to be when I was collecting
probably.
Them. You know, I could see paying, you know, $17.99 for these.
Sure.
Easily. I think even for collectors, maybe $24.99. I think the $35.99 is a little steep. But at the same time, you know, I think they'll sell them all. And they're the kind of things, you know, I mean, you're not buying these to play with them, obviously. And you're really not even buying them to take them out of the package. So, you know, I guess maybe that's the going rate. I mean, it's it's like 300 yen, right? So, but some nice toys for collectors. And
yeah,
we'll
definitely
have links to those and the images in the show notes. You can go check them out.
Yeah. So obviously these figures have some interesting makeup. The salt vampire, the green alien, Christine Chapel's wig. And another character with some interesting makeup on her was Jadzia Dax from DS9. And she, of course, was played by actress Terry Farrell, who sat down, was it last week, with StarTrek.com for an interview?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, Terry Farrell's case was kind of interesting coming into the show because I think she was the last person to be cast on Deep Space Nine. And they had, I think, a difficult time casting the character of Jadzia Dax because, if I recall from all the things I've heard over the years, they, you know, they wanted the character, although the Trill, Dax Trill, or the Dax symbiote is very old, they wanted the Trill character to be a young woman. And of course they wanted a good actress because, you know, on Star Trek, they need to play against Avery Brooks and Colm Meaney, people like this. They need a good actress, not a visitor and all. And, casting directors have always said it can be very difficult in Hollywood to find very attractive young women who are also very good actresses because they often will find models who maybe don't have as much acting experience. And finding a combination of both can be difficult. It limits their options a lot more than it would when they're casting some of the other characters.
Yeah. And I just saw Transformers 3, and that casting a model does not go well.
Yeah, it often doesn't go well. I mean, sometimes it can. I mean, you get people like Terry Farrell or Jolene Blaylock who have done excellent work. But
Jolene was great.
It's not as easy as, not that any casting is easy, but it's not as easy as casting, you know, Picard or somebody like that.
Yeah. So it sounds like Terry didn't have the greatest time on DS9. Obviously, she started being the last person cast. And then, if you remember from TNG, there was an episode where they had a Trill on the show. I believe this is right. And there was some sort of forehead makeup. But then when they gave Terry Farrell that forehead, I think they didn't like the way it looked. And so they had to redesign it. So they had to reshoot all of her scenes. And so she came right out of the gate. She didn't know any of the other actors. Like, everyone else seemed to know each other when she got there. They had to reshoot everything she did. She had these late, late nights. And I think it just put her off on the wrong foot for sort of joining the Star Trek family. And it seems from what she was saying that she doesn't feel like she was prepared for the role and she just didn't have the stamina for it.
Yeah, it seems that way. Now, that never came through to me on camera, but behind the scenes, that seems to be the case. I'm really glad they got rid of that forehead. I've seen images of that before, and that didn't work. And I mean, for one thing, if you're going to go to the trouble of all this casting to find an attractive model who can act, and then you're going to put a big prosthetic forehead on her, kind of defeats purpose. But
to be honest, I think Roxanne Dawson looks just as good with the Klingon ridges on her head as she does in real life. So sometimes the makeup can work really well with the actress, but I think with Terry Farrell, it managed to really detract from her.
Yeah, I'd agree with you on Roxanne Dawson. But one thing about the Klingon ridges is that they have been used so much that they are now able to make it look extremely natural to where you don't feel like, I mean, with B'Elanna, you, especially in the later seasons of Voyager, you didn't feel like there was, that this was a prosthetic. I mean, it looked very, very natural. Whereas this forehead that they had on the Trill, and that they tried to put on Dax at the beginning, I mean, it was really a noticeable, very distracting thing. So, but she talks about, all this time on DS9. And of course, everyone knows how Jadzia Dax left the show at the end of season 6 in what was, I have mixed feelings on it because, on the one hand, I was glad to see that they actually pulled the trigger on knocking off a major character because it gave the show a more real feeling than when you know the major characters are never going to die.
Yeah.
At the same time, like we talked about with Kirk's death scene in Generations, the way it was handled, it was just so, it was the very, very typical actor wants out of the contract.
Yeah.
We have to kill off the actor scene. The way that Jadzia died was so unfitting. And yeah. I really was disappointed in that.
Yeah.
But
it sounded like behind the scenes, like her contract was up and she had no desire to re-up it. And I think the writers weren't happy with it, and the writers just said, well, that's it, you're dead. And they didn't put as much thought into it as they would have if it had been a character. Well, and I don't know exactly how to say this, but if it had been something that the producers and the writers really cared about, I think they would have put a lot more effort into it. And I think it did manage to come through on the show, the sort of behind-the-scenes stuff that was going on.
Just
at the very end.
Yeah, at the very end. Well, there are two ways. There's that, and there's also the fact that in the series finale, What You Leave Behind, when they have the flashback sequence, there are no images of Jadzia Dax.
Right. Yeah.
Which is ridiculous. I mean, they're doing a flashback of the entire series of all the characters, and there's no Jadzia Dax.
Yeah.
And that's obviously because they couldn't come to an agreement on the use of the footage for whatever reason.
One
thing I've heard this, I don't know if it's 100% true or not. I've always heard over the years that for whatever reason, the studio signed the actors to Deep Space Nine originally to 6-year contracts instead of 7-year contracts.
Right.
Which, given the fact that TNG ran 7 years, I don't know why they wouldn't do a 7-year contract for DS9.
Right.
Even if they decided to only go 6 years, they could negotiate it down. But trying to sign everybody back for a final season, and it just made it extra easy for Terry Farrell to leave the show, I think, because her contract was up. So it wasn't a negotiate out of the deal. It was a, I don't want to come back for the final extended 1 year kind of deal.
Yeah, there's an interesting thing in the, we're going to talk about the captains later on. There's an interesting bit in the captain's documentary where Sir Patrick Stewart was a little unsure about signing on for one of these lengthy contracts, but his friends told him, you know, this is just some dumb sci-fi show. It's not going to get picked up. So just go ahead and do the pilot and sign the contract. It's not actually going to happen.
Yeah, I remember hearing that. Yeah. I think after TNG, the success of TNG, the actors going into DS9 maybe had a reason to believe that they would be around for the long term.
Yeah. It's interesting. So what is Terry Farrell doing nowadays? I haven't seen her on Eureka.
No, she hasn't been on Eureka, and she won't be, thanks to you. But it sounds like she's just being a mom and a wife, and she says she's a registered yoga teacher, and she teaches a class at the local rec center. It must be interesting to sit down and study yoga with Dax.
Yeah, really. It would be interesting. Yeah. That's another thing that Shatner was talking to Kate Mulgrew about, how you be a mom and a Star Trek actor or an actor in general. And she said, basically, it's impossible. And I have no idea how I did it. And I definitely understand, once you have a family, just not wanting to bother with the stress of, you know, 18-hour days and getting put in makeup and just all this stuff. It's, if you don't have to, why bother?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's hard enough to do a normal person's job, you know, when you have all that going on in your life, much less the kind of hours that these actors and actresses pull on these shows.
Yeah, definitely.
So, well, speaking of beautiful actresses who have graced the screen for Star Trek, as we continue in our interview show today, as it's turning out to be, there is Alice Krieger in a Technorati interview. They're doing, I guess, a series of interviews as part of their recognition of the 45th anniversary of Star Trek. And this time it's the Borg Queen, Alice Krieger.
Yeah, and definitely one of the most memorable villains. Neither a captain nor a guy. This is actually a queen. And she put in a fantastic performance in Star Trek First Contact. Even though she was wearing loads and loads of makeup, and being given kind of ridiculous things to say. I think she really pulled off, especially in her scenes with Data, she pulled off that menace and not even menace, but sort of seduction of the good guys that you really love to have in a bad guy. Not just, oh, I'm going to go and I'm going to kill everyone, but actually saying, you know what, you guys could join me and then, you know, everything would be even better than if I have to kill you.
Right. I often hear her referred to as creepy sexy by a lot of fans. And it is that kind of creepiness to her, but then as it was played, of course, with Data in First Contact, this kind of sexuality or sensual nature to this Borg queen as well. And especially in First Contact, I mean, this character, it's almost like the character was made for Alice Krieger, or Alice Krieger was born to play his character, because when they brought the Borg queen back in Voyager and they couldn't get Krieger, and they brought in Suzanne Thompson to play the part, there was just, I mean, Suzanne Thompson did a fine job of playing the character, but there was just something missing in the character when it was played by her.
Yeah, she gave to something to her performance. It was just so otherworldly. You obviously can't just put anybody in that makeup and have it come across. Some people are really, really good at acting through the makeup and really connecting with the character. I mean, she said she had basically no knowledge of Star Trek before doing this. She had heard Beam Me Up, Scotty, somewhere. But she sat down with all of the TNG episodes with the Borg and just let it all wash over her and let the idea of the Borg really get into her so that she could play this character. Even though the Borg Queen wasn't a concept from TNG, she still was able to sort of embody the concept of the Borg in a really memorable way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, talking there about what she brings to the character, I wonder if she had not played the Borg Queen first, and then we saw Suzanne Thompson playing the Borg Queen, would we still have that same feeling that there was something missing? And I guess it's kind of hard to answer that question, but I kind of feel like maybe we would still. Like the power behind the character wasn't there.
Well, what I think happened, what my thought was, is that Alice Krieger really created this idea of what the Borg Queen is like. And I think if she hadn't originated the character, it probably would have been completely different had someone else played it. And maybe Voyager actually should have gone in that direction and said, you know what, we sort of did that creepy, sexy thing. Let's go in a completely different direction with this Borg Queen. Maybe she approaches the job from a different angle. I'm not quite sure what that would be, but I think that could have been interesting. And that way, no one would be making that comparison, because it's so hard to follow in someone's footsteps and try to redo such an iconic performance.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm glad that they were able to bring her back for Endgame.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
For the finale of Voyager. Because that really helped, that helped a lot with that storyline. Well, you know, speaking of sexy characters, there is a huge Enterprise following on Twitter, a huge group of Enterprise fans on Twitter, who, although they don't describe this next actor and character as creepy sexy, I do often get tweets with the word sexy tied to him, and that's Connor Trinneer, who played Trip Tucker on Enterprise.
Yeah. And now, I actually learned in this interview, or learned while doing research on this interview, that Connor Trinneer was actually born in Walla Walla, Washington. Whereas but his character on the show spoke with this southern drawl that I just loved. I just love the way he brought it. Obviously, we had Scotty in the original series and then Geordi on Next Gen. And I loved having like a southern engineer who brought that. I don't know. Somehow when he spoke the techno babble, I really connected with it because it sounded like back home.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And it's interesting that he was born in Washington State, because, you know, often you hear people, you know, you're a Southerner, I'm a Southerner. I don't sound like a Southerner, I guess, but I am. And I grew up there. And often when you hear people doing Southern accents in movies or on TV, they're really fake. It may not be as noticeable to people who aren't Southerners, but to us, you can nail it. It's like, wow, it's just a fake accent. But Connor Trenier, the way he played Trip, I mean, it was so natural. And I think one reason you connected with that is because it was so natural and it was believable, and it made him this kind of everyday guy. Of all the people on that ship, Trip was the everyday guy. Yeah. And Scott Bakula played Archer very, I think, naturally as well. Like you felt like Archer was a natural guy, not like it's very different than what you've seen in the other captains. But but even beyond that, I thought that Trip was so natural, the most natural character on that show, and I always connected with him. And I haven't really thought about very much who's my favorite character on Enterprise, but it probably is Trip.
He's definitely up there. I love the way he says "Cap'n," you know.
Yeah.
I can't do that, Captain.
And the other thing with him, with the character, is that he was so casual like that, yet he was kind of the second in command, basically.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he was, because T'Pol at the beginning of the series was not a member of Starfleet, and Trip was a commander, and he was the second highest ranking officer after Archer. But he was the everyday guy, too.
Yeah, which it makes a lot more sense to have your commander be the chief engineer. I mean, I guess, I don't know, as Starfleet progressed, we ended up just putting lieutenants down there. But it makes sense to have, like, one of your most experienced guys being the person who runs the engine. And, you know, maybe he doesn't need to be up on the bridge all the time. It's good for him to be where the action's going on and doing things that take a lot of work. So it was an interesting dynamic that you had sort of the second in command not on the bridge all the time. But he did outrank everyone, which comes up a few times, especially with, now I'm completely blanking on his name, the armory officer, played by Dominic Keating, was?
Malcolm Reed.
Thank you!
Yep.
When he was interacting with Reed, and he was always like, they were friends, and they had this good friendly relationship, but you knew that Trip was, even though he was very casual, he was higher, and he was able to give orders.
Yeah, right. So often with the Star Trek actors, in some of these recent interviews, we've seen them kind of be disgruntled or not enjoying their time on the show. But in this case, Connor Trenier was basically the opposite, I think. He seemed to very much enjoy his time on Star Trek.
Yeah, definitely. He said that his time on Enterprise, and also he did about 10 episodes on Stargate Atlantis, and he said that this was like the best acting experience of his life, which is really good to hear. That it doesn't sound like there was too much behind the scenes. He said very briefly that he'd pitched some stories with his wife, who's his writing partner, and they hadn't taken him up on it. And, you know, just in general, none of the Enterprise actors were allowed to direct, which was a big change from the previous three shows, where they really encouraged actors to become a part of the process. But he didn't sound bitter about it or anything. He just was stating that, you know, that was part of being on Enterprise. They just wanted him to come and act, and he was happy to do that.
Yeah, right. And he was, because of his role on the show, I mean, he was, like, you have Kirk, Spock, McCoy on TOS, you know, and you have Picard and Data on Next Generation. And in Enterprise, you basically had Archer and T'Pol and Trip as your three, you know, primary characters. So he got plenty to do, which, of course, helps to not feel disgruntled there. And I think he got material that he enjoyed. He found challenging and he enjoyed playing.
How great were those dinner scenes with Archer and T'Pol and Trip, where they just having casual conversations over dinner about the day's events?
Yeah, it was very unique in Star Trek, and Trip and Archer kind of enjoyed harassing T'Pol a little bit because of her lack of sense of humor as a Vulcan at that point.
So, yeah, right.
One thing he said in here that I kind of found interesting was that he said that he really hated the Mirror Universe episodes.
Yeah, this is weird because this is basically the fans. If fans don't like Enterprise, they at least liked the Mirror Universe episodes, where we brought back the a Constitution class ship and saw everybody in those old uniforms. Now, what have did we get to exactly why he hated it?
I think, if I understood what he was saying, he just didn't like the maybe it was playing this character, but then having to play this character in a different persona.
Yeah.
And the way the director wanted him to play the part. He said something like he he would play the part one way, and the director would say, like, I want him to be a little gruffer. And then and then Connor says, oh, you mean like a pirate? R. And then the director's like, cut, print. And he says, no, I was just kidding. And the director, no, it's great. That's what we're doing here. You know, it's kind of like this. Like, I think he wasn't happy with the what he was being asked to do as an actor, maybe.
Right.
More so than not liking the concept of a mirror universe, perhaps.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely, as an actor, you center in on what you're actually doing from day to day. And if you're having to do this ridiculous, you know, I don't remember Trip being a pirate, but, you know, if he felt like he was doing this ridiculous caricature of himself, I could definitely see that being an unpleasant experience and not something he was wanting to revisit.
Yeah, that would have been unpleasant, although it wouldn't have been as bad as if the director had told him he also had to wear the puffy shirt from Seinfeld.
Or the miniskirt from Encounter at Farpoint.
Oh, gosh. Or both together. All right. Oh, well, one other thing from this interview, he was obviously asked about whether or not he buys into the belief by a lot of fans that Enterprise was responsible for killing the franchise,
right.
Basically.
Yeah.
And I will just say that I totally agree with what he said here, which was, I thought he was spot on. He just said that, look, our ratings were within the range of what DS9 and Voyager were doing as well. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, how many years can you keep this going? We happen to be the show that was on at the point when the studio just said, stop. We're not going to do anymore. And also that they were just kind of like the elephant in the room at that point at UPN. They were no longer what the network was interested in doing. They weren't the target audience that the network was going after. And I think he's right. You know, I think it just all boils down to business. It wasn't that the creative killed the franchise or anything like that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think it was one interesting thing he said is that all the shows take a couple years to find their sea legs, and Enterprise found its sea legs and then was canceled. It's not that they were canceled while they were trying to find themselves. They were there when they got canceled.
Yeah, they did. And they found their sea legs at about the same point in the series that the other series did as well.
Right.
They just got canceled.
It was just,
you know, many, many factors.
Yeah.
Well, you know, everyone wants to have new Star Trek on television. I know I would like to. And we talked a while back about, you know, we talked to Zero Room about an animated series concept that they had. And then we talked about some other ideas for future TV. And now the Bad Robot team behind the J.J. Abrams reboot are looking into an animated series.
Right. So the writers of the first Star Trek film, the first reboot Star Trek film, and the next one, are Roberto Orci and Alex Kurtzman, who do a whole bunch of stuff. But they're also involved in the new Transformers. I don't know if it's even a reboot, but the Transformers movie series. And they've done a sort of reboot animated show that they're producing as well. And so they're sort of getting into this whole animated thing. And so they were asked by another podcast called My Geek Time about the possibility of doing an animated show. And apparently it's actually something they've already been talking to the studio about. As we talked about with Zero Room, it's kind of impossible to know who owns the rights, who owns the rights to Trek on TV, who owns the rights to animated Trek, who do we actually have to talk to make this happen? But they sound like they're actively interested in making it happen.
Yeah, it seems that way. And like you said, one thing that Orci said here, it's just very similar to what the Zero Room guys told us, which is that one of the first things is to go in and find out who owns the rights to this and that, and can we do this and that. And I think in this case, because they are already doing the movie, that even though Paramount owns the movie rights and CBS owns the TV rights, I think it's going to be possibly an easier path for them because they're already the creative team behind what's going on in the movies. It'd be interesting to see if they make headway here and they bring this forth. Now, is there any word on what their concept is?
So far, absolutely nothing. Although I would assume, based on the comics that IDW is doing, that Orci is also involved in, I'd assume that this would be in the Abrams universe, that it would involve the young Kirk and Spock and that cast just sort of showing these same adventures. It'd be interesting if they did the kind of the same thing the comic is doing and sort of redo original series episodes with the Abrams twist. But really no official word on that.
So you would be interested in seeing an animated series that was doing remakes of TOS episodes with Abrams verse?
I'd be interested in one that did it from time to time, that maybe started out
but
doing...
But not every episode.
I wouldn't want every episode. I wouldn't want, you know, three seasons of just, you know... Yeah. There's no reason to redo Shore Leave, but take some of those interesting concepts from the original series and put a new twist on it and show some other adventures, too. Could be
All
quite
right.
interesting.
Well, if they do it, I think the pilot episode should be a remake of Spock's brain.
Definitely.
So, I think you talked to Zero Room to kind of get their thoughts on this, didn't you?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask them and see what they thought of it. And I did get a statement back from Jose Munoz, who told me, anything that keeps Star Trek alive and thriving is good for the brand and fans. We just hope it will be as good as ours. And I think I definitely agree with that. Obviously we need to see what Orky and Kurtzman are coming up with, but basically anything that keeps Star Trek on TV is great, even if it's Abrams universe and it isn't a continuation of the classic Trek TV stuff, I still think it's good.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, kind of the animated series, TAS kind of bridged us from the original series to the next mm-hmm. generation. I mean, there was a big gap there, but you know, maybe this can bridge us to a future live action series as well. And and maybe this will get us Trek on TV while the Abrams movies are in the theater, because otherwise, you know, we may not get other live action Trek that's not Abrams as long as those movies are going on, as we've talked about before.
Yeah, and what I'd really love to see this do is air on something like Cartoon Network and sort of bring that younger generation into Star Trek. Because right now it's kind of only older people who remember TNG who are really getting excited about it. You're not really getting that solid core of Trekkies coming up from those younger generations. So
yeah,
I'd love for
that's
right. that to happen as it's happening with Star Wars with Clone Wars. So hopefully we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. It would be nice to see. And one more thing here, speaking of Star Trek over the years and the original series, and we're not going to get Spock's brain quite yet. That's going to come in the future. But our favorite band, 5-Year Mission, has announced finally pre-orders for year two are open.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I've been following their tweets on Twitter. And then talking about the recording and laying down vocals and all the tracks. And I've been wondering, you know, when is this coming out? When is it coming out? And we do get a release date of December 9th. And if you pre-order now, it will be $10 and they'll ship the CD right to you. And it has some pretty good episodes in it. You know, they're not doing season one, season two, season three. They've sort of split the episodes into 5 years. So this time we're getting Arena, we're getting Court Martial, and... One interesting one for fans of our show is that Space Seed, which episode did they play Space Seed on? People can go back and listen.
On the third episode of this podcast, we had 5-Year Mission as a guest, and they sat down and they did a few acoustic performances for us. From year one, they did The Menagerie, and then they gave us a sneak preview of what's coming up on year two, and that's, Greg, as you just said, Space Seed.
Yeah.
And so we'll put in... link in the show notes here, and you can jump back to show number 3 and check that out. It was really great to see it live performance, acoustic, and I'm really looking forward to year 2.
Yeah, definitely. I'm hoping we can get them back on the show as well come December to maybe play some more of their songs and talk to them about the process of promoting themselves. I believe they're playing at Gen Con in Chicago this weekend, so they're just getting bigger and bigger and building that momentum behind them. I'd love to see them getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, they are. All right, and one more thing, Greg, before we go today, I just want to throw in a couple of quick Trek FM items here. I wanted to let everyone know that one thing that we've been asked about quite often is member accounts on the Trek FM website. Because we have a login link on the site for our editorial team. And people have asked us, how can I log in to Trek FM? Mm. And we're really happy to announce that we've now opened up the entire site to membership. And if anyone wants to sign up, you can create a free member account. Just go under the community link, which is new on the menu bar, and you'll see membership registration. And when you sign up, you'll be able to comment on all the articles and posts around the site, and have some discussion with other Star Trek fans. And we'll have some other exclusives. You know, we have some exclusive content like special wallpapers, avatars, things like that, which we don't have available to the public. Previously, they've been there for our newsletter subscribers, and that stuff will be available to you as well. Once you've logged in, you'll see new menu items that weren't there before. And we're going to be rolling out other content and for you to have as member exclusives in the future.
A great way to interact with us other than just on Twitter. It'll be great to have comments and such on the site itself. I'm really looking forward to this spreading.
Yeah, we can break free of the 140 characters. So everyone has their favorite captain for different reasons, and today we're going to discuss all the captains from the Star Trek television series. And of course, Greg is with me, and also joining us today is friend of the show, Brian Finifter.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Hi, good. Thanks for having me back again.
Good. Good to have you again with us. So why don't we just jump right into the captains with the first on-screen captain, anyway, Captain Kirk. So, Greg, tell us your take on the good Captain Kirk.
Captain Kirk. Well, obviously, he's the one who launched the whole thing. So I guess part of what launched us into talking about the captains was that William Shatner's documentary, The Captains, was released in the past couple weeks, and I finally got a chance to see it. And he talked about how, obviously, they made a pilot with Jeffrey Hunter playing Captain Pike, and that was called The Cage, and the network didn't like it so much, and they went to William Shatner. And he was able to watch the tape of The Cage and sort of think, you know what, that's maybe not what I would do with a captain, and sort of come up with his idea of what a captain should be like. And so he didn't actually have to invent the idea of a Starfleet captain, but he did have to invent his version of it. And he went an interesting direction with it, I think, in making him be this very jokey captain. Like, he didn't take things extremely seriously. And all the other captains took things extremely seriously, but Kirk never seemed to. Sometimes he was in a life or death situation, but he was sort of like Spider-Man from the old comics, where he's always got some joke to make, which I think I like, but maybe is quite different from the rest of the interpretations we've seen.
Yeah, I think Pike was, it's hard to tell because all we saw of him was this one episode, The Cage, which of course never aired, but was a very boring character,
right?
At least to start with. So then when they, I can see why the studios maybe didn't go for that, although I think it was less about Pike and it was more about the overall story concept.
Right.
But what William Shatner brought to it was, I guess, more and appropriate for the time when the show was made, was more of that cowboy attitude, kind of carefree cowboy attitude towards everything. And of course, we know from, as the series went on and the movies came on, that he never believed that, he didn't believe in the no-win scenario, and thus he didn't believe that he was going to die. And so
right.
Maybe that's also this kind of jokey attitude that you mentioned.
Yeah.
So, Brian, would you want to serve under Captain Kirk and a more carefree captain like this?
it depends on, it would depend on what the color of the shirt I was wearing. Although, I mean, to be
right.
fair, a lot of yellow shirts buy it in Next Generation as well. But of course, the original series has that propensity towards it. If I were on the bridge crew, yeah, absolutely. I personally, if it were me, I would want to serve under Picard. I'm more of a Picard guy. I mean, I grew up on the Next Generation primarily. Kirk is a really fun character in terms of, watching it as a television show. Shatner just has this huge over-the-top personality and just has this sense of bravado and machismo that's really, really fun to watch. And I think what you were mentioning earlier about, you know, he doesn't seem to be taking it quite as seriously as some of the later captains. And I think that's very true in the sense that Kirk is, it's not an institution. Star Trek wasn't an institution when the original series was on the way it was by the time Next Generation came around, and especially as you go further down the line into Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and Enterprise, where, and Kate Mulgrew talks about this in the Captain's documentary, where it's like, when she got the part, it was like, okay, I am now a Starfleet captain. I am a captain of a Star Trek starship, and that is a big, big deal. And I think that kind of gravitas, especially after having Patrick Stewart play, you know, the next Starfleet captain, and just the natural gravitas that man has doing anything, brings a certain quality to it that Shatner and Captain Kirk never had really had to deal with. He was able to have a lot more fun with it than anybody else ever did.
Yeah, I think one thing he did that I really liked was he talked things over, especially with McCoy and Spock, and he tried to think through decisions by having a conversation. Picard didn't do that much. Picard tended to know what he wanted, know what he thought about something, and he'd make a speech, and then he'd win the day. Whereas Kirk may have been joking, but he never seemed to be exactly sure that his opinion was right unless he talked it over with his friends. And I think that's a really good quality to have as a captain, to know the strengths of the people around you, the strengths of your bridge crew, and know how to use that in your captaincy.
Yeah, I agree with that. He was never as isolated or portrayed as isolated as some of the other captains were later on, especially Janeway in certain moments of Voyager.
Yeah, that's true. Even though the supporting characters on TOS didn't always have a lot to do, you know, Sulu, Chekov, Uhura didn't always have a lot to do. I guess if you think about it, there was more of a feeling, though, that crew, along with the captain, was more of a doing things as a team, as opposed to, like you said, on the Next Generation, where Picard is pretty much giving orders and typically not asking for a whole lot of input, or maybe he asks for some input and then he'll just say, noted, now get off my bridge, right, or something, you know, on those lines. Or he'll ask Data because he knows Data, being a computer, has some
or he'll
insight.
Ask Forge to look out the window.
Or some of the terrible instances where Wesley will have the right answer and be trying to tell everybody the right answer, and Picard will just yell at him for no real reason.
As my son was trying to tell you.
Yes, my son was trying to tell you.
Ugh. That's right. And he says, well, I only talk to you in sick bay, but as our Dork Trek friends would say, Picard has to go to sick bay to consult on everything. What are some other, let's say, I guess every captain has pros and cons. Now, obviously, that's one pro of Kirk. What are some other pros that you see in Kirk?
I also, as a
captain.
One thing I really liked was that because we've got six films with Kirk, they were able to really flesh out his character in the movies more than they were able to really in the show. So I think the character from Kirk in my head is mostly movie Kirk and not so much how he acts on the show, which could probably change from week to week depending on what he's doing. And often he's doing something really strange like The Enemy Within. But he got this really interesting sense of, we talked about last week, the mortality. And he got this sense of realizing he was getting old and realizing, you know, what did he really want out of life? And that was really interesting to me and something we didn't really get into with the other captains too much. I think he got some glasses at one point, and it's kind of strange to have people in the future still getting glasses. But just that he had to wrap his head around, you know, I am this jokey guy who doesn't plan to ever die, but I'm going to have to. And that really was incorporated in all of the movie stories.
Yeah, I'm the same. For me, Kirk is mostly movie Kirk when I think of Kirk, because that is where things are mostly fleshed out. For me, I think another con for him is that he's, even though he may be coming across as not taking things too seriously, he always has a solution. When we talked about Generations, we talked about how he stayed quiet on the bridge of the Enterprise B until Harriman asked him for input. But as soon as he was asked, he jumped into motion and he had a plan, do this, do this, do this. I guess I would be maybe a little bit nervous serving. Well, serving under Kirk would be fun, I think, as an adventure. I would be a little bit nervous that I was going to get killed because he's a bit more certainly more reckless than Picard, for sure. At the same time, I also would feel like, you know, that I was with a captain who always had a way out,
right.
That there was always a solution. I think, again, mentioning the Dork Trek guys a minute ago, one thing they pointed out is how many times at the beginning of the first season of TNG, Picard surrendered.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
Kirk, you know, is never going to surrender. And if he ever does surrender, it's because he has something up his sleeve, like when he had the Klingons board the Enterprise in the search for Spock after he activated the self-destruct sequence. There's always a way out. So I find that a pro. But it could be a con. The reckless nature could also be seen as a con as well.
It's interesting.
It's true. Picard does love to go to the self-destruct button as, like, pretty much plan A.
Yeah.
If the Enterprise encounters any difficulty, we'll go straight to the self-destruct button in a very dramatic fashion. Which my favorite time of that is in Nemesis, where he goes to the self-destruct option after losing the battle, and then the self-destruct option is offline for whatever reason, which
imagine
you're just
that.
Talking about explosion, you know, an explosive,
right.
And the engine of your ship is a very delicate thing that you have to try really hard to not make explode. But that's not really a captain related thing, but it's just one thing that really, really annoyed me out of many things about Nemesis.
So I wanted to mention one thing about the no-win scenario. I don't want to get too far down the Abrams verse rabbit hole because we only got one movie with Chris Pine, but how do you think that aspect of Kirk will be changed in the movies going forward, because his father did run into this no-win scenario where he died saving people's lives, and Spock sort of pointed that out to him, that, you know, you're not going to live forever. You know, if you really want to be a hero, sometimes you're going to have to make sacrifices, and you might even lose your life doing it. So how do you guys think that's going to affect his character going forward?
Well, I don't know, because he obviously had the aspect of his dad in his history, but he still dealt with the Kobayashi Maru in the same way. He still cheated and won and avoided facing the no-win scenario. Honestly, I think he'll probably be in whatever, you know, shape Abrams and Ortiz and Kurtzman and Lindelof decide to take him. Generally, the Captain Kirk that we know and love, the really, like, the brash, the confidence, the reckless, the Captain Kirk that just really thinks he can do no wrong, and because he's Captain Kirk is right. Because really, that's
so.
The character. That's the essence of the character.
Yeah, I think so too. Because again, we did see the Kobayashi Maru play out just as we knew that it had. But I think that although his father ran into this no-win scenario and his father was killed, you also have to remember that he never knew his father.
True.
I mean, he was born at the moment that his father died. So he only knows of his father from stories. And it's a very weak connection between him and what happened to his father. And at the same time, I think what they were playing up in that movie is that because his father died, he has a reckless attitude towards things. He kind of knows, like, well, we don't know yet in the Abrams verse if they're going to play the Kirk saying that he knows he'll never die. He'll always
alone.
Die alone, or he thinks he'll you know, live forever kind of thing. We don't know that. But I think that maybe he knows that, well, his father ran into the situation and his father did die. And so things could end. You don't know when they're going to end. And so he takes this more reckless, carefree attitude towards things. So, yeah, I agree with Brian. I think we'll probably see pretty much the same Kirk that we...
And we also have to remember that the line of, oh, I know that, you know, I would always die alone, comes from The Final Frontier, from Star Trek V. So it can't really count.
Right, it's true.
So you're saying it doesn't count.
Yeah.
Because that movie is not canon, right?
According to Gene Roddenberry, you know, nobody ever pinned him down on specifics, but I think the quote goes that pieces of it he did not consider canon, which I always assumed to mean that it was anything related to the plot of flying to the center of the galaxy or whatever Anything related to that aspect of it was not canon, but the actual relationship stuff.
I think so.
Pretty much any scene that's Kirk, Spock, and McCoy and just them interacting with each other is decent and occasionally moving, depending on the part of the movie.
Yeah.
And so I would imagine that stuff is would be safely considered canon.
For Gene, it was probably the whole bit about God, maybe the kind of
I mean, I'm sure that's definitely part of it.
And
although it does turn out to be a false god, you know, it turns out to be an alien. So who knows? Sadly, we'll never get to Gene Roddenberry's specific thoughts on it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, so at the very least, if we say that, as I was saying, if a big part of Shatner was his mortality, that's not going to be a note they're going to be playing with Chris Pine's Kirk, I assume, because he's not getting on in years, at least not yet. So it'll be interesting to see a movie Kirk
is
even younger than he was in the original series and see what that does to his character.
Yeah, that's a good point.
He's the youngest captain,
things will
which is
play
interesting.
Out differently. Yeah.
Yeah, because even in the prime continuity, he was the youngest captain at, like, I think 33 or something was when he was promoted to captain. And now, I mean, and you can make arguments about how believable it is or not, but now he's, like, what, 27 or 28 and he's captain? So it's which is a really ridiculous age, but it is what it is. So he has years and years and years, you know, in within the universe, he would have years and years and years before he would ever consider himself an old man.
And at this point, Kim was still an ensign and still had many years of ensignry to go.
Yeah, well, Kim got the got screwed on the other side of that that sword. Whatever Kirk did to get promoted in half an hour, Kim could not get promoted for the life of him. Poor kid.
Well, I think a more realistic
that's a good point.
A more realistic thing was shown in Picard, who was on his second captaincy at a pretty ripe old age, I think. I think it makes a lot more sense where Picard was. So maybe we can move on to Picard 100 years later.
Yeah, so Brian, you said that you're a Picard guy, pretty much. Mm-hmm. So explain why you're a Picard guy.
Well, accepting, you know, his early on when they're still figuring the character out. I mean, once they have actually figured out who the character is and Patrick Stewart has really, you know, put his mold onto it, I would feel the most comfortable. I would feel like, you know, because when you're serving under a military commander, I was in ROTC in college, and so I've served in a certain capacity. I mean, being in ROTC isn't really being in the military, but I've served in a certain sense under superior officers who I respected and whose judgment I implicitly trusted and who I was willing to follow. And there were commanders that I did not absolutely in any way, shape, or form. And that's the ultimate, that's the most important aspect of serving under your commanding officer, whoever it is. It's having that sense of trust that's, you know, you're putting your life, you are literally putting your lives in their hands, and they're going to ask you to do things that, you know, you're not going to understand the logic of because they're not going to have time or nor the inclination to make you privy to all of their reasoning. Just not feasible. So you're going to have to take on trust doing whatever it is they ask you to do, which could up to and including mean giving your life, sacrificing your own life, or doing something that may result in your death, which is the most extraordinary relationship that requires the most extraordinary amount of trust of any possible relationship on this planet between human beings, I think. So in terms of that quality, which I think is the most important quality, the person in this fictional universe that I would trust the most implicitly and whose judgment I trust the most would be Picard.
It's really interesting. And I think I agree with that, definitely. And I think that part of that comes from the fact that I think Picard spends a lot of time thinking about being a Starfleet captain and thinking about what it means to be someone that's part of Gene Roddenberry's utopia. Like he believes implicitly that he needs to be better than we are in the 21st century. He needs to be a better person. He needs to have better morals and treat people better and be respectful of other races. I just watched the episode The Big Goodbye, where he's really worried about saying this really complicated greeting to an alien race. I don't think Kirk would have cared about that.
I don't think so.
Something Picard is saying, you know, I think it's really important that the Federation be friends with as many people as possible, because that's really important for our society philosophically. And so I feel like when Picard makes a decision, it's because he's already thought about it and he thinks this is the right thing to do. And that's why I can trust him when he does something. He doesn't usually do things for personal reasons. It's pretty much because there's a philosophical, deep-seated, thought-through reason.
Yeah, with the thing with Picard is you always, and largely because of, you know, the kind of actor that Patrick Stewart is, you always get the sense that he's really thought everything mm-hmm. through as much as is humanly possible. Kirk is great as a character because he can kind of just, like Indiana Jones in a sense, he can just kind of fly by the seat of his pants and it will all work out no matter what. That's because we know that, you know, the writers are looking out for him. The creators of his universe are looking out for him. And of course they are for Picard too. But with Picard, you get more of a sense that he's really thought every situation out as much as is humanly possible and is not just flying by the seat of his pants as much as is possible. Yeah.
One really interesting thing that from the Captain's documentary was that early on, Patrick Stewart was very serious in the role, and he wanted everyone on set to be very serious. And he actually said he yelled at them at one point for joking around too much.
Yeah. And he says they still haven't changed. Let him live it down. Yeah.
And so eventually he came around, but I think that was part of what made the first few episodes a little shaky with him and his relationship with the others, just that he wasn't letting himself be incorporated into the cast. And so Picard also didn't become like a part of it until later.
Yeah. And it's also if you go back and watch the early episodes of The Next Generation,
right,
you can see that they've written Picard to be a much more stern character than he ends up being, because Patrick Stewart eventually Patrick Stewart's natural kind of warmth and compassion eventually shines through, and Picard turns into the Picard we know. But early on, he's very cold, and he's very isolated, and very aloof and stern, and right. just kind of mean, which is kind of how they originally set the character down to be. Which fortunately, Patrick Stewart eventually changed that. But yeah,
Chris, let me ask you a question: wanted to go and watch an episode or a movie that showed me essential Picard, like when you think of Picard, what episode or movie do you think of that I would get that sense?
Good question. I don't know if I can pin it down to one. I think that when we talk about the kind of trust that the crew has in Picard as a captain, I think that All Good Things is a great episode, because it allows you to see him in the three different time periods. And, you know, we know in the present of the show that the crew trusts him, but you also get to see that in the past, when the crew is just getting to know him, that he still commands this kind of trust and loyalty from the crew, even though they do finally question him. I mean, Tasha finally demands that we have to have some explanation. But he even tells her that he can't give her an explanation, and they do ultimately trust him. And I think that's an example that he does command that faith and trust from the crew. And then in the future time period, when he has this Alzheimer's type disorder, and everyone is kind of thinking that he's kind of losing it, but they still have enough loyalty and trust in him to ultimately take him on his word, which of course it turns out to be what saves everybody. In terms of movies, you know, I think that probably Insurrection might be the best example of real Picard, that because First Contact does a bit for his character development, but in First Contact, he has this kind of vendetta, which is kind of not really Picard. It works fine in the story, but I think Insurrection and the way that he approaches the Baku and the fact that they, at first they think that they are a pre-warp civilization, and then he finds out that no, they do have warp capability, and just this kind of the way that the Federation approaches non-member worlds and other cultures, and how strongly Picard feels about those ideals. Insurrection is a great example of real true Picard for me. Well, what about Khans in Picard? What type of negative aspects to him as a captain do you see, if there are any that stand out to you?
I honestly, other than moments where I don't think he's written all that well, to be honest, and especially early on in the season, I would consider, I wouldn't want to really serve under the Captain Picard of the first season, because he's stern and he's kind of meaner than is necessary. I don't know. I really don't.
Yeah. It's not too many cons. As a viewer, I guess I'd like, I don't so much like that Picard spends so much time on the bridge during the show. I'd like him to be more a part of the away missions. That's sort of the thing they did with the show, was have Riker do more of the away missions. He seems to be kind of stuck on the bridge for most of the show.
Right, which he himself as Captain Picard doesn't like. I think he's not happy about. He often kind of jumps at the opportunity to go on an away mission. Yeah. I think sometimes Riker doesn't want him to go, but Picard's like, let me have this. You even see that finally he lets loose in Nemesis when he gets to drive the Doom buggy across the planet.
That was fun.
It's like, finally, I'm going to go do this. And I think that's one of your favorite scenes.
Right? I love every moment of Star Trek Nemesis with all of my heart. Every single frame of that wonderful piece of cinema.
So I think we can agree that Captain Picard is maybe an ideal captain.
Definitely.
That you would want to serve under. So what about the next captain that we got, which was Sisko? Quite different from the other Starfleet captains, and very, very different from Picard, who was his contemporary on the air at the time.
Yeah, so different. They even started him off as a commander. They said, we're not going to have a captain. We're just going to have a guy who is assigned to this space station. Yeah, Sisko is an interesting thing, mainly because watching this captain's documentary with Avery Brooks, he's so different from the character we're used to seeing. And I'm not sure where the Sisko character comes from, because it's Patrick Stewart is so similar to Picard, and William Shatner is so similar to Kirk.
Yes.
This is maybe the first captain that was a wholly created concept from the actor's mind.
What Greg is trying to politely say is that Avery Brooks is insane. And if you watch the captain's documentary, I don't think he strings one sentence together that makes any kind of sense, that an earthling, a citizen of planet Earth, would be able to listen to it and go, yes, that statement makes a reasonable amount of sense. He's whatever planet he's on, it's not this one. And it's like, I always knew that for as long as I've watching DS9, right. I go, behind the scenes, he's kind of an out there kind of guy, which is fine, which is great. But I don't know what it's turned up to 11 on the captain's documentary. He's just out there. And it's like, you could almost see that the editor of the documentary was like, well, we haven't cut back to Avery for a while, so I guess we got to go. All right. So we just spend 5 minutes with Avery, and then we'll go back to Kate Mulgrew or Patrick Stewart, who have, very insightful things to say.
It's funny because I haven't seen the captain's documentary yet myself, but I have seen Avery speaking in other situations, and I know exactly what you're talking about. And because of that, when I watch Sisko, if I really look for it, I can see a little bit of that in Sisko from time to time. Not that Sisko's coherent, but it's just kind of the passion behind the way that Sisko
says things from time to time.
You get a little
bit of Avery there. Emotional outbursts every now and then. And,
in Sisko, they're only occasional.
With Avery Brooks, they're a little more frequent. But I know what you're saying.
But as a captain, and especially the situation that he was in, where he was put, in the beginning, reluctantly stationed to Deep Space Nine to kind of head up this, what was supposed to be getting Bajor, or as Picard says it, Bajor, ready for the, to be admitted into the Federation, which of course all changed when the wormhole was discovered, and then the ultimately the Dominion War began. But as a captain and in that situation, I guess, does Sisko work for you, and would you want to serve under Sisko on the station or on the Defiant? How about you, Craig? You look like you're ready to dive into some Sisko.
I don't know. Sisko's probably the captain I'm least familiar with, just because I've only seen DS9 straight through once, and I've gone back and seen bits of it. And I like the character, but I'm not sure if I can say whether or not I'd like to serve under him. I wouldn't want to be on DS9. It seems like the worst place to be in the Federation, because it's the kind of the center of the war, it feels like, and... The Cardassians are always around trying to stir up some trouble, even in the early seasons. And the parts I've seen the most are early on, and he doesn't get along with his crew much. He doesn't get along with Kira. He doesn't really get along with Bashir.
Because he doesn't want to be there in the beginning.
But eventually...
There's a lot of what that's about.
I'd love to hear what you guys have to say. Eventually... Like, he has this great arc, and I'd love to hear what you think of that arc, where he actually ends up as a character. Because he starts out, like Picard, being someone I wouldn't really want to spend much time around.
Yeah, I would. I feel like if I were assigned to Deep Space Nine, you know, whether I wanted to be there or not, but if that's where I ended up, he would generally be the kind of guy I would want in that situation, because he's a little angrier. He's a little more... He just doesn't take any crap from anybody. He's less diplomatic than Picard, and that was certainly done on purpose, which I think it was the rights. Mm-hmm. It's the rights mentality, the right mindset to have on a frontier post like that, where it's, you know, you're going toe to toe with, you know, the hostile former managers of the place, you know, every other day, and you don't have the luxury of the kind of diplomacy that Picard always did. He's gonna tell you the way it is, and that's the way it is. And if you piss him off, then you're gonna know it. And I feel like that's the right mentality for a frontier post like DS9 was.
Yeah, I agree there that it was the right kind of character for that show. And as we saw, when a captain like Picard, I think, would not be able to run Deep Space Nine as a station, because you had to deal... most Starfleet captains and admirals that we see come in, and even security personnel that we have seen come in on Deep Space Nine from time to time from elsewhere in Starfleet, they're accustomed to working within this structure that everyone on the ship is a Starfleet officer or an enlisted, you know, a chief or something. And they're not accustomed to having to deal on a day-to-day basis with races from outside the Federation or shady elements or even people like Quark, who are relatively harmless but don't play by Federation rules. And so you needed that kind of angrier, less diplomatic character for sure.
Yeah, like there's so much going on the station that Sisko has absolutely no control over. Picard has such an iron grip, I feel like, on the Enterprise D. Like, nothing happens without his say-so. But on the station, I mean, his first officer isn't a Starfleet officer. Nobody on the promenade really cares about his opinion of anything. And so, you definitely have to approach things. And the show itself was much more of an ensemble piece, where people are off making decisions.
Oh, definitely.
And they don't even talk to Sisko about how to proceed. They just... talk about it and decide what to do and go do it. And then sometimes Sisko finds out and is angry, but that's not at all what Picard would do.
Right, right. So another thing about Sisko that, you know, as far as, you know, a captain I would want to serve under, yeah, probably wouldn't be Sisko. It would probably be Picard. But as a captain on a Star Trek series, I felt like the character of Sisko is a very interesting one for me because we get to see, probably more than in any of the other captains, we get to see a development of this character of Sisko over the course of the series. In the original series, we really didn't see any development of Kirk. I mean, he's pretty much the same guy from the first episode as he is in the last episode. And Picard, we saw a little bit of development in terms of how he was written. But through the series, Picard is pretty stable. He lightens up a little bit. But, you know, he, like you said, he has this iron fist in a gentle way, but everyone knows that he's in charge and he kind of stays there. Janeway, we see her struggle a bit with having to take on maybe more of a leadership and motherly role than she had anticipated because of the fact that they were alone. And in Archer, we see him start to get accustomed to being out in space because they were so new. But it's all of those are fairly minor character developments over the course of a series. But with Sisko, we get from this reluctant human who just doesn't want to be there because he doesn't want to be at the station to someone who goes from being a commander to being a captain, who finds out that he is a religious figure amongst the Bajorans, which he doesn't want to be, and he's reluctant to that. And then we see him become seeing Bajor more as his home. He kind of comes to terms ultimately with the fact that he is a religious figure and that he is kind of the prophets. And so it's just this drastic development of this character over the course of seven seasons, which makes him one of the more interesting captains for me.
He has the biggest visual change aside from, well, maybe Janeway changes her hair quite a bit, but the fact that Sisko at one point shaves his head and grows that goatee, I know Ira Stephen Bear has talked about having to convince the network to let them do that, that they were sort of changing.
Yeah, he wanted Avery to dye the Sisko beard blue too, right? But they wouldn't go for that. Sisko's blue beard,
the way I understand
right?
it was, it, that look, the bald with the goatee, was the same look, you know, it's the look he normally has, and it was the look he had for a previous television show that he was on, and they wanted him to have a different appearance, at least in the beginning, to help distinguish. Although that might have been just kind of a network's rationalization to make him look less, you know, less angry, a little more friendly to the white bread home audience. Who knows? But that's a story I've heard.
Well, it definitely made him. It definitely made him less authoritative. Yeah. I think, you know, he was a commander. Later, he becomes a captain. When he's a commander, he has this younger look. He has the hair. He just doesn't command authority as much. And then when he went to the shaved head and the goatee and he became a captain, he does have a much stronger presence.
Yeah, definitely.
For me there. He feels much more authoritative and much more like the captain at that point. So it could also, at least maybe unintentionally, it was done. But I think that maybe that visual change, when you take the series as a whole, was a good thing, and it plays up the position they put him in.
Yeah, definitely.
So what about our next captain, Janeway?
I would, in a heartbeat, I would serve under Kate Mulgrew. I would never in a million years serve under Captain Janeway.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If you watch the Captain's documentary, she, Scott Bakula, and Patrick Stewart all have really insightful things about, you know, what it's like to work on Star Trek and to be kind of the center of a franchise and have all that kind of riding on you. And she's a very assertive, you know, no takes no crap kind of a woman. She tells a story in the documentary about how she wanted to go to New York and be an actress, and her dad was like, there's no way in hell you're going to college, and if you're going to do this other thing, then I'm not paying for it. And she basically lied to her father about being in college for a semester and studied with Stella Adler, I think it was, studied acting. And just because, you know, that's what she wanted to do, and she knew it, and by God, she found a way to get there. So as a person, Kate Mulgrew is awesome. As for Janeway, I really sympathize with Kate Mulgrew because she's a wonderful actress that had really difficult situation to deal with, in the sense that her Janeway as a character is just written all over the place. One week she's the mother, and the next week she's Sisko. And it just goes back and forth, sometimes within episodes. And I just watched as much of Voyager as I could stand recently. And I rewatched the series finale, and there's no clearer display of Janeway's kind of schizophrenia of her personality and the way she makes decisions in character and her character than when she is literally arguing with herself in the series finale about whether to do this one thing or whether not, whether it's too dangerous to risk the crew, or whether, by God, no matter, you know, damn the torpedoes full speed ahead to get her crew home. It's just, she's all over the place, written-wise, from a writer's standpoint. And as a result, she's not a very consistent person. And it gets to the point where if you were serving under her, you'd have no choice but to go, Captain, are you okay medically? Like, psychiatrically, are you okay?
I think the doctor did
there,
ask her that.
There are several occasions, and there's occasions where Chakotay challenges her as well. It's just the problem is, you know, she does these things or she doesn't do these things, and the doctor or Chakotay or whoever challenges her or doesn't challenge her, depending on the week and depending on the hour, unfortunately.
Yeah, and then Chakotay usually backs down,
as we talked about last week. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I wish she would... She's more like Picard than Kirk, in the sense of she doesn't really talk over her decisions with people. I think she tends to stay in her quarters or her ready room and think about what to do. And sometimes she thinks for a long time. But I can't remember too many times that she's asked Chakotay or Tuvok to come talk to her and then actually took their opinions. She tends to... I think a couple times she's asked Chakotay his opinion. It's not been what she was going to do. So she said, well, screw you. I'm going to do it anyway. And I wish I could have had you on my side.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's the best way for a captain to act.
I wonder if she may have been, of course, we would never know this, but if she were the captain of Voyager and Voyager was just another ship flying around the Federation all the time, if she may have been a little bit different, maybe the intent is that the character has the weight of the world on her shoulders because she feels responsible because she made the decision to destroy the caretaker array and strand them there. And now she feels that it's her duty to get them home at all costs. And you see that. And one problem that I have with Janeway is that she makes a lot of very irrational decisions, whereas Picard, thinks things through, and most of the time Picard's decisions are very rational. And Kirk makes reckless decisions, maybe rational or irrational, but he also is of a different time period when things were a little bit more Wild West for the Federation and for Starfleet. And for Janeway, sometimes I just look at her decisions and I'm like, you know, Chakotay or whoever is telling you, you should listen to them. You know, they're making sense. I mean, you should just determine that she's going to do it her way, no matter what. And often gets the crew and the ship into a lot of unnecessary danger because of that. And so, you know, as a crew member, I would be a little bit nervous serving under her as a captain as well for that reason.
I mean, it's easy to follow the prime directive when you're in the Alpha Quadrant. And you can always just fly home. It's a little bit harder for people like, for Janeway and then for Archer as he was sort of developing these concepts. It's a little harder when you have to make, you know, spur of the moment decisions, stuff that, you know, could affect the lives of your entire crew because you're so far from home. There's no one to ask. So I think she did have that weight of the world on her shoulders, and it probably led to a bit of her being unsure of things and sometimes making a decision that doesn't jive with what she would have decided the next week. She was in a really, really difficult situation. And I have a hard time, you know, sort of Monday morning quarterbacking her decisions just because she was in such a difficult position.
But you think she should have maybe consulted more with Chakotay and the crew and listen more to the crew than she did.
It would have been nice if she'd had a bridge crew that was who she chose. Like, she didn't choose her first officer. Yeah.
Well, except for Tuvok.
Tuvok, but she didn't really, I don't know,
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think Chakotay is the only person on, if you really look at the bridge crew, that she didn't choose.
Well,
I mean, everybody else is Starfleet, you know, except for Tom,
she reluctantly brought in Tom. Yeah.
I think it's just that she hadn't been serving with them for years and years. Like, Kirk and Spock and McCoy had this bond, and there was no way for Janeway to have that bond, because there was a divide between Tuvok and Chakotay. There was a divide between Chakotay and Janeway. And there was only that weird relationship we never really quite got fleshed out between Tuvok and Janeway. But even so, she never really took his advice. And I just think if she'd had the sort of relationship that Kirk had, she could have talked to more people. She could have made more rational decisions. But, you know, you've got to go to the Delta Quadrant with the bridge crew you've got. And I think she didn't have the best...
That's what they say. That's what they always say. You got to go to the Delta Quadrant with the bridge crew you got.
Yeah, I don't know if I could lay it on her crew. I think it's just, if you look at the character, she's just, you know, from week to week, what her character is changes and what her priorities are and what she really gets fired up over, whether or not it's keeping her crew safe or getting her crew home despite the risks or... You know, however they decide to portray it on a week-to-week basis, it doesn't line up with any kind of consistency, unfortunately.
Well, so Janeway is what we get at the tail end of Star Trek on television. So if we roll all the way back to the beginning, we get Captain Archer. And in Captain Archer, of course, the other captains, including Kirk, had the benefit of Starfleet having been around and the Federation having been developed and become accustomed to various alien races. But for Archer, things were really quite new. First Warp 5 ship for Earth. And in the first few episodes, they really kind of play up this kind of wide-eyed nature that the crew has. Pros first of Archer. Greg, what do you see?
Well... One pro with Archer is what I was talking about with Kirk, where he has this really good relationship with his command structure. What he has, we talked earlier about Trip, the engineer, and even T'Pol. He gets this relationship with her, and they get that. I almost use a word I shouldn't use, but they get that triumvirate of people together that are able to talk and think through decisions and come to rational choices about what to do. Because he really does have a difficult road to hoe. I mean, you know, when you come across an M-class planet, you know, what do you do? Does the whole bridge crew go down? Do you send a probe down there? When you come across a pre-warp civilization, what do you do? And he has to make those decisions for the very first time. And I think he ends up doing a really good job of it, because the people who are with him, he trusts them and they trust him.
Yeah, I feel like Archer has a good sense of humility, almost. I don't know if that's exactly the right word, but humility at the fact that, okay, we're about to go where no man has gone before, and we have no idea what's going to happen, and let's just hope it's something we can deal with. We really have no idea whether that's the case or not, though. So he has a real a solid quality of humility without sacrificing a sense of presence or command or of authority. So it's a balance between, you know, having the confidence of we'll be able to handle whatever comes our way, but at the same time acknowledging we really have no idea what's going to come our way. I think it's another case of the right captain for the right situation. Unfortunately, I mean, the writing of Enterprise doesn't really bear that out the way it could have been borne out, but in terms of the character and specifically Scott Bakula's portrayal of it, I would feel comfortable serving under Captain Archer. I think
I feel like out of the gate he was a great character, that there was a real solid character there, whereas the other captains, I know you say Janeway never never found her character, but he came out of the gate in the pilot being the captain that he pretty much was for the rest of the series. And I think that's really
great. I would agree with that, actually. Yeah. And maybe that comes from the facts of Scott Bakula having already carried a TV show. Yep. and just knowing what goes into that. But I definitely agree with that.
Yeah, me too. Then, as his character changed over time, what did you make of season 3 with the whole Zindi arc, where we get a little bit more of this archer who's on this drive? It felt like a bit of a change for the character in season 3.
You know, it's been a long time since I've watched any Enterprise whatsoever, so I'm not sure how well I could speak to that. I do remember they took it in a much, with the whole Zindi arc, they took it into a darker direction, a quote-unquote post-9/11 kind of mindset. So it was, the idea was for these characters to be, you know, a little more paranoid, a little more ready to jump on the gun if they needed to. And to be a little more scared of everything, a little more afraid.
That they didn't have the Prime Directive at that point. That if they had had the Prime Directive, Archer would have been, you know, violating it left and right, I feel like, in the third season. But since it hadn't been invented, he was just saying, you know what, we've got to save Earth. We've got to do whatever we have to do. And he was, like we said with Janeway, sort of out there on his own, having to make a lot of decisions. And I don't know, I prefer first and second season Archer. I think he's this, I love the way he approaches these new situations with a bit of humor. I don't like it when he's so much under the gun and under so much pressure. I'm not sure if at that point he's a captain I would like to serve under. I definitely would want to be on his crew leaving Earth, you know, but...
Yeah.
Taking those first
steps.
So
if we take the... Yeah, if we take the Zindi part out, that whole sequence out, the rest of Archer's time is captain on the ship under more normal circumstances. He's a captain that you feel comfortable serving under, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. What about cons for Archer? Are there any things that stick out to you that might kind of make you nervous of him as a captain anyway? I mean, some people, I think, say tentativeness of him.
Right.
It's kind of a criticism of the character from some people that they think that Scott Bakula didn't play the character well because he's the captain of a starship, and yet he's kind of cautious and tentative in the beginning. But as we've said before, I think that's the way the character should have been played, because that's real. That's how you would feel.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the other side of the coin of the humility aspect that I was talking about earlier, of we don't know what the hell's what we're going to find out here. I don't know. In that situation, would you want a captain more like Kirk, who it doesn't matter? He's going to be brash and confident no matter what. Quite honestly, I would prefer the unpleasant truth versus the pleasant deception, and I would prefer whoever I was serving under to be able to acknowledge the truth of a situation. Versus having a kind of a pleasant self-deception when it comes to, oh, whatever it is, we'll be fine because we're the Enterprise and we're awesome and I'm Captain Kirk. I'm Captain Kirk.
I'm Captain Kirk.
But that, you know, that's my preference though. Other people might prefer that kind of supreme confidence that can conquer anything and everything.
I'd say if there was a real negative to Archer, it would be his relationship with the rest of the crew. He was real good friends with Trip, became good friends with T'Pol, but stuff like his relationship with Hoshi or Malcolm Reed, Mayweather, he just never quite connected with them, and they seemed to go off and do their own thing, and they never...
Have a relationship with Mayweather?
I'm not sure if he ever talked to Mayweather. Mayweather, who was that?
I'm not sure if anybody did.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if Mayweather ever talked to anybody. I think he just sat up front.
There was
and
an episode.
Pushed the buttons.
Yeah, which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
But that was how it was written.
Yeah.
So
I think Archer could have made an effort to know more of his crew. he did feel like he had his little group and they had dinner together. And
yeah,
you know, sometimes he tried to have somebody come have dinner with him and it just didn't go very well. I think Picard did a little bit better job of being everybody's captain.
Yeah, maybe so. All right. Well, why don't we wrap this up with the results from our captain's poll that we have been running on Trek FM, because we've expressed our preferences here, who we would want to serve under or not and why. And we ran this about a week-long poll of the question was, under which captain would you prefer to serve? And because there is a very active group of Enterprise fans who got very organized as Team Archer, and they rallied Archer to the top of the pack here. And he had 36% of the vote, and he won. Picard had 32%. Janeway had 14%. Kirk had 10%, and Sisko had only 7%. And, you know, I have to admit that at first glance, the results with Archer winning, considering that Enterprise only had four seasons and it came in at the tail end, and it's a series that a lot of the fan base kind of dismisses, it kind of surprised me a bit. But as we talk, it doesn't surprise me quite so much, because if we do talk about the qualities of the captains, I think that Archer is a captain that I would feel comfortable serving under and would like to serve under. I think Picard is my first choice, but after Picard, it could be Archer.
Which other captain was elected president of the Federation? I ask you that.
That's right.
That's true. Although if Picard was interested in politics, he could have won it, I'm sure.
Probably could have.
Probably. I mean, he goes on, at least in some timeline, he goes on to be an ambassador.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Picard's kind of the John Kerry of captains. I'm not quite sure if I would have voted for him.
Oh, wow. Those are fighting words, mister.
All right. Well, those are some good words to close out the show with, the feature with anyway. So, all right. Well, Brian, thanks again for joining us today to talk about the captains.
Oh, my pleasure, guys. Anytime.
And just give a quick plug so everyone knows where they can find you around the web.
Always. I have a Twitter. You can always find me at my Twitter, Brian Finifter, BRIANFINIFTER. And then I'm also a co-host on a podcast called Down in Front, where we record our own movie commentaries to movies. So we'll pop in a DVD and we'll sync up our commentary to the movie so you can watch it along. And then we just have wonderful conversations that are, we try to at least make them hilarious and insightful and engaging and entertaining. So if you're interested in checking that out, you can go to downinfront.net. And we also have a great little forum where we have some really cool conversations about movies going on too as well. So check that out.
So that was a fun talk, Greg, with Brian about the captains. Everyone has their own view of the captains, no doubt.
Yeah, I don't know if I've had that in-depth of a discussion about the captains with anyone. And I actually don't think that my views quite lined up with especially Brian's as much as I assumed. I think I like Janeway quite a bit more than he does. So it was interesting to hear that. I'd love to hear people's thoughts of it as well, our listeners.
Yeah, and I think I kind of like Archer more than maybe I realized too. Just if I just stop and think about how he approached the captain's seat and how he led the crew and how I would feel if I were on the ship compared to the others, because I always love Kirk. I mean, Kirk is, it's hard for me. I'm kind of like in the Weird Al video where he says that the only difficult question I've ever had is whether I like Kirk or Picard, right?
Right.
I'm kind of like that. They're kind of always been my two favorites. But yeah, I'd be a little bit nervous about serving under Kirk, I think. So anyway.
Or Captain Pike in the new film.
Yeah, maybe
pretty dangerous
so.
As well.
Yeah. And you know, the results of our poll were interesting. And yeah. And the Archer fans were very well organized. And he won the poll. Actually, when I think about Archer and Picard top two, makes a good bit of sense to me.
I think it does.
When the question is who you would want to serve under as a crew member. Speaking of that poll, you know, what I was thinking that we might could do is that because everyone has these strong feelings about the captains, is we're going to put together a little essay contest for Trek FM and just ask people to tell us in fairly short, maybe like 500 words, why they would want to serve under a particular captain, why they love that captain, and why they would want to be a member of his crew. And it will be fun to hear everyone's opinions and views on this. And then we'll pick some of those and we'll publish them on the site. And then we'll get some of Trek FM's editors together and we'll pick one for each captain and we'll do a podcast on the captain's log for it.
That sounds great.
If any listeners are interested in that, just watch the site and we'll put up more details as soon as we have it all fleshed out. So speaking of the site, Greg, let's just remind everyone, come by our site at trek.fm for all kinds of Star Trek features, news, podcasts. We've got all kinds of stuff going on there. And also you'll find us on Twitter. Our username is trekfm, and Greg, we'll find you on Twitter as well.
Yep. So I'm on Twitter as Greg Harbin, GregHarb, as in boy, IN.
And I'm on Twitter. You'll find me under C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/trekfm. And one more fun thing to do is to check out Trek Trivia on Twitter, as well as on our site, Trek Trivia. We have multiple choice quizzes every week, and the current quiz is, very appropriately, the captains, and that will be running through the middle of next week. So by the time you hear the show on Monday, it'll still be up. So I encourage you to go check that out. And if you want to drop us a note and tell us what you think about the captains, you can also do that at trek.fm/contact, or you can leave us a voicemail by calling 646-652-TREK. Well, Greg, that does it for another discussion.
Yeah, Chris, I think it's time to stick a toupee in it, because the Ready Room is done.